Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young. On today's show, we dive into the Earth Eats archive for some favorite stories, conversations, and recipes.
I think what's happened with baby food in the last 10 years is so interesting and kind of completes the story in a very interesting way.
Annie Corrigan talks with author Amy Bentley about baby food. She talks to a rancher and a restaurateur, all coming up on Earth Eats. Our news team has the week off, so we'll start with Harvest Public Media.
It's not cheap to treat water that's been polluted by farm runoff, and cities surrounded by farmland are concerned the cost is going to keep increasing.
For Harvest Public Media, Clay Masters looks at the challenges that cities in intensely farmed states face when it comes to clean water.
There's an upcoming city council election in Des Moines, and voters here have questions about the city's source water, which has had high levels of nitrates that, untreated, can be harmful to infants and pregnant women. Voters are asking candidates like Michael Kiernan,
is it safe to drink, safe to consume?
Nitrates occur naturally, but are also a byproduct of nitrogen fertilizer that farmers put on their fields by the ton. The Des Moines Water Works spent more than $2 million over 2 years cleaning the river water it uses for its 500,000 customers. The utility sued drainage districts in upstream farm counties, a lawsuit that could have changed the face of farming in the upper Midwest. But a federal judge said any regulations must come from the state legislature. It shouldn't be a political issue, says city council candidate Abshir Omar, who has a firsthand experience with living with contaminated water. He's a Somali refugee who also lived in a refugee camp in Kenya.
And for us to live in the wealthiest nation in the history of the world, the most technologically advanced society on planet Earth, that we have to fight for clean water, I think that's a shame.
The deck is stacked against cities like Des Moines, says Mark Ryan, an attorney who spent 2 decades with the EPA.
Cities are not in the driver's seat on this. They're being driven.
Ryan, speaking via Skype, says because farm runoff is not regulated, cities have to spend a lot of money cleaning up water. And there are examples from the Chesapeake Bay in the Northeast to Boise, Idaho.
Litigation usually doesn't benefit many people, but sometimes that's the only thing left. But I think we're going to have to get creative if we want to solve the long-term problem of ag runoff.
One solution is having farmers change the way they manage their land and how they apply fertilizer to keep nitrates from going downstream. And right now, that's just voluntary. Tembar Dole farms more than 2,000 acres in north-central Iowa's Greene County and serves on the board of the Iowa Soybean Association. He says the Des Moines Waterworks lawsuit left many farmers out here mad.
It gets more anger and emotion into a problem, which makes it very hard to solve or improve on the problem.
Bardol farms with his father, brother, and son. They've changed how they do things to help address various issues, such as planting 1,500 acres of cover crops this year. That's a way to keep more of the nitrate in the soil and out of waterways. Tim's son, Skyler, says cover crops cost a lot.
But we see it as the best thing to do for the soil, for the environment, and just the longevity of the farm itself and the ground. And when it comes down to it, too, I mean, we drink water, too.
The state of Iowa and farm lobbyist groups don't want to put more regulations on farmers. But that's not good enough for the Des Moines Water Works. The utility's general manager, Bill Stowe, says the lawsuit may have been dismissed, but they won't back down.
Our responsibility really requires us to stand up into a headwind, even when that headwind is not just industrial producers, polluters, if you will, but the national and state governments themselves.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue recently signaled the Trump administration wants to eliminate more regulations for farmers, but he did not specify what those might be. And U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt says his agency is in the process of redefining water regulations and believes in traditional oversight from states. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Clay Masters in Des Moines.
There's more where that came from harvestpublicmedia.org. Next, we go to the kitchen with Annie Corrigan and Chef Daniel Orr for some recipes featuring cool weather crops.
A while back, we asked for requests of ingredients to cook with in upcoming recipes. Plenty of our Twitter followers asked for Brussels sprouts recipes, which we have coming up. The first one is a treat for me personally, and it uses some delicious local maple syrup to boot.
I think I was the one who requested recipes for turnips because I have so many and I can't figure out how to make them tasty.
Well, turnips, you know, they're kind of a forgotten vegetable, an old-timey vegetable, but they are delicious. And their whole dishes in France called navarins, which are all about the navet, which the French turnip in French is navet. And so a navarin is a stew made with turnips. It usually has lamb in it, so that's a wonderful dish. We're going to do something more kind of Hoosier and down home, using Tim Burton's maple syrup. So what you need to do is pick out a nice turnip. They should be shiny. See how that it's kind of shiny, and if you feel the texture of it, very, very smooth. If it's wrinkly and soft, then it's not going to be good. It's going to become kind of bitter from being in storage too long. If you can get them with the greens, the turnip greens are edible as well. Cook them just like anything else. If you love pork, throw some bacon in there, stew them down. Delicious. If you don't, you could use some toasted walnuts with them, a little bit of balsamic vinegar, great way to cook the turnip greens. Again, a little bit of sweetness always helps with the greens too, because they can be a little bit bitter. So just a little bit of honey, agave, even some brown sugar would be fine, just a pinch. You don't want to be sickly sweet, just to kind of cover up that touch of bitterness. So basically with the turnip bulb, what we're going to do is dice it up. I would say about half inch pieces, and then steam it off. And you'll come up with a turnip much like this. Now, this is a little hot, but if you want to taste it, it should still be a little bit crunchy.
You just throw this in your mouth. It's so hot. Oh, my God. Okay, crunchy. Well,
crunchy. All right, so we have these ready. They're cooked. They're hot. They're kind of steaming. Now we're going to put together the sauce for them. So just a touch of oil, minced onions, teaspoon, garlic. Just going to let those become a little tender. We don't want them to be super soft. And I'm going to throw a couple dried chili peppers. We're going to leave them whole, and that way we can take them out. So if you're wanting to get a chili flavor, but you don't want to have it too hot, so that's always a good trick. I just added about 2 tablespoons of maple syrup. And now I'm going to add some chopped kumquats. I've got 4 kumquats. They look like little tiny oranges, and you can eat the whole thing. You can eat the skin and all. You can squeeze out the seeds, but I even eat the seeds. And they've got a really nice perfumey orange flavor. Okay, we're going to dump our turnips in, and that's about 1 large turnip. This would be enough for a side vegetable for probably 4 people. And finally, just to make it a little bit better, we got my butter. And the butter is going to enrobe the turnips, give them a nice shine.
Maybe that's the thing. I'm not cooking my turnips with a tablespoon of butter.
Well, the butter, I mean, when you're eating all these great local vegetables, a little butter is going to make them even more special and something to look forward to. Okay, I got the sweetness, touch of spice. I get that little bit of orange flavor. I'm going to throw in some greens just to make them look pretty. This is some chopped parsley and scallions. Let me put these out on the plate. You can give them a try.
Serve this dish with a pork chop, some grilled chicken, or a fatty piece of salmon. Nice side dish and very colorful. See photos and the complete recipe at eartheats.org. Brussels sprouts lovers are going to love you.
Yes, ma'am. We're going to turn everybody into a Brussels sprout lover today. What we've done today is we've blanched them, and blanching means that we've taken some boiling salted water and we've plunged the raw vegetables into the boiling water, cooked them until they're al dente, and al dente means to the tooth in Italian, and then we've plunged them into cold water, which is called shocking, and you really want to use ice water. That brings the temperature down, keeps the integrity of the vegetable, and keeps them nice and green colored.
There's some chew there.
Yeah. We're going to cook them again, so we don't want to have them overcooked. But I really like that they're crunchy. They're almost like a crudité vegetable. You could eat them cold like this and just dip them into a blue cheese dip. I mean, that'd be a delicious way to enjoy Brussels sprouts. We're going to heat up some oil in a sauté pan. And I've got round discs of polenta. And polenta, basically in southern Indiana, it's what we call cornmeal mush. All right, so we want to get a nice brown crust on both sides. So it's crunchy on the exterior, and then it's nice and soft on the inside. And what we're going to do is use those on the bottom of the plate with some taleggio on top. And Taleggio is a wonderful Italian cheese. It's kind of like a super stinky brie. So if you like brie and you like funky cheeses, you're going to love Taleggio. And I don't get it all the time back here in Indiana, so it's fun when I find it, and I wanted to share it with everybody at Earth Eats. Okay, now it's starting to crunch up on that first side. This is one of those things you don't want to rush. The more you move it around, the harder it is to get that nice crust build on the outside. It's kind of like mushrooms. You put them in there, you let them sit there by themselves. Don't try to move them around too much, and your final product will be a lot better.
Hard to not fiddle with your food when you're cooking it.
Right? You always want to check it, look in the bottom, but it's very, very important that you get a nice crust on these. Sprinkle them with just a little grated Parmesan. You can hear that cheese starting to sizzle and stick to the bottom of the tray. And this is the part of the process you really don't want to rush. They should all be able just to kind of slide around. Okay, you know they're ready when you can kind of shake them around in the pan and they don't stick. Okay, I'm gonna take this, put this on a side plate. And then with the same pan, I'm going to cook our Brussels sprouts. So what I'm gonna do is I'm going to plunge them into the hot water and just to kind of warm them through a little bit. In the meantime, I'm going to put some chopped garlic into the saute pan. Okay, my Brussels sprouts are pretty much hot and there's a little bit of water still on them. Throw those in the pan. Okay, and now I'm gonna make up a plate. Okay, so I got a couple of the polenta rounds on the plate. We're gonna surround it with some steaming garlicky Brussels sprouts, slice of the Taleggio, and just a little bit of chopped herbs. Touch of olive oil to give it a shine. And those are some of the best Brussels sprouts you'll ever have. Go ahead and let me know if I'm right.
All right, let's go check this out. It's nice. Whew, this really was a good one. You can experiment with making your own polenta or pick some up from the store. Either way, definitely do not forget that Taleggio. That's really the key to this recipe for sure. Get more inspiration for your kitchen adventures on our website, eartheats.org.
Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
It took Amy Bentley 19 years to write her book, Inventing Baby Food. She worked on it sporadically as she was raising her kids. They served as guinea pigs for her field research, she says. She fed them commercial baby food and organic food and some baby food she made at home. She says this made her more empathetic to women of every era who also looked for the healthiest, the most convenient, and the most affordable way to feed their babies. Her kids are all grown up now, so it was time to finish the book. And she's glad she waited so long.
I think what's happened with baby food in the last 10 years is so interesting and kind of completes the story in a very interesting way.
Amy Bentley is also an associate professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She stopped by the Earth Eats studios this fall. And starting on page 10, you have this graph here that sort of sets up the entire argument for the book.
I found myself referring back to this over and over. And what it shows is at what age babies were first given solid foods. Starts in 1880, and they're 11 months in age. And then it goes to 2000, and we see that babies are 5 months average when they get solid food. Summarize what you're trying to tell us with how the trends change over the years.
Yeah. The graph is telling because it starts in the late 1800s, as you said, and babies are first given solid foods about 9 to 12 months of age, sort of when teeth appear. It was thought that, you know, that was an appropriate time to start solids, and the first foods were soft foods, gruels, beef broth, scraped beef. There wasn't really a category called baby food. There was just this category of soft food that was designed for babies, invalids, sick people, anybody who needed sort of a softer, blander diet. Those were the first foods that were given at that time, 9 to 12 months. When you get the rise of industrialization, the manufacturing and proliferation of baby food, then that age of introduction of solids starts to decline. And between the 1920s and the 1950s, it just sharply drops. So by the post-World War II era, the average age of introducing solids was 4 to 6 weeks.
We're talking about the 1950s and 60s. And you're right, at this point, infants are getting solid food at an average of 2 months, which is the earliest that they've gotten it on this grid.
Yeah.
So now the pushback comes in the 70s. So we're thinking consumer activism is starting to happen. The beginning of the food movement is starting to come around. This idea of natural motherhood and making your own baby food. Describe what you mean by natural motherhood.
This is part of the whole counterculture 70s that is exploring new alternative ways to live. And food is one of the things they're exploring. And so in the early part of the 20th century, the ethos was a scientific motherhood. And that was, you are not capable of taking care of your child without the realm of science and the world of experts. But in the 1970s, you have a different ethos, and that this ethos is what's called natural motherhood, and that this is the exact opposite. Trust your own instincts, distrust science, distrust the experts. And so food is one of the things that where this is played out. And so a lot of people are seeing the commercial baby food as unhealthy and so are turning to making their own as the alternative.
You would think that after everything that we've been talking about, backlash in the 70s, the food movement is in full effect right now. You'd think that commercial baby food, as you know, they knew it in the 30s, would be long gone. Not so. In 2011, Americans spent $6.2 billion on baby food. That's a figure from your book. Gerber had 3/4 of that market share. But now we're seeing some small-scale baby food manufacturers come on the scene. Let's talk about these new players and how they're changing the game.
Yeah. In the 2000s, before the recession, in 2008, there were several small startup companies, and it was the right time for them to produce a different kind of baby food. They were dissatisfied by what they saw the general commercial manufacturers making. Taste was important for the first time. And so many are turning to homemade. So there's definitely a big strain and ethos to make your own baby food. But many still wanted the convenience of commercial baby food. And so you have small boutique baby food companies.
I don't know when the last time you were at a baby food aisle of a grocery store, but can you talk about the different sorts of flavors and dishes that they're offering now?
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest changes is the delivery system, which is the pouch. And so you can open the top and you can squeeze the baby food out on a spoon and feed it to your baby, or you can just hand it to your child and the child can squeeze it and glug it down themselves. And that's a logical extension of the jar. So it's an even more convenient delivery system for baby food. The flavors are more unique. So you've got quinoa and kale and kiwi flavors. Wow. You've got barley and salmon and amaranth. So they're trying to definitely appeal to a more cosmopolitan palette of flavors. You know, they're doing very well. And the commercial baby food manufacturers are following suit.
I want to one last time go back to our grid on page 10. So it stops at 2000. I don't suppose we know the average age at which infants are getting solid foods for 2010. Do we know that yet?
Well, the advice is 4 to 6 months.
Which is still where it is.
Yeah. And that has not really changed. However, I think what's happening today is something really interesting. The practice that's been in favor for a while is introduce food slowly, one at a time, wait a week in between foods, and check for food allergies. And some pediatricians are saying, if you wait and introduce foods one week at a time, the kid's going to be, you know, 15 months old before they've had kind of a decent array of foods. Better to introduce foods earlier and more frequently and help further promote that palate development for a wide variety of flavors, tastes, and textures than to wait. It's really an interesting potential reversal of introducing solids, and we'll kind of see where it plays out.
Amy Bentley is the author of Inventing Baby Food, Taste, Health, and the Industrialization of the American Diet. More from this interview is at eartheats.org. Let's get cooking with Daniel Orr, a traditional British dish called bubble and squeak. Three ingredients for this one, some fat of some sort, potatoes, and...
You would normally just add cabbage, but we're going to use some Brussels sprouts. And then we're going to stir it with a little bit of, you could use bacon fat, you could use butter, you could use olive oil, and it will actually squeak and bubble in the pan. That's why they call it bubble and squeak. All right, so for the Brussels sprouts, I just slice them and then steam them off quickly. You could blanch them in boiling water and then shock them with cold water so they keep that really nice color. So our butter's nice and hot. We add the potatoes. You can hear it kind of sizzling. And then when that cabbage starts to really heat up, it'll give a little squeak. All right, so what you're getting is you're starting to get a little bit of brown. Give it a little taste. I love this stuff. And there's nothing more late wintry than that.
Daniel has a recipe for stew coming up today as well. Rancher Dave Fisher has developed relationships with area restaurants. They buy his products directly from him. Back when he was starting out, he went door to door, meeting people in charge of purchasing at restaurants. He would usually drag along one of his kids. One of the first doors he knocked on was Nick's English Hut. Greg Rago answered.
Everybody calls me Rags. My title is I'm a managing partner, owner of Nick's English Hut. It's kind of an interesting story. Dave and I met. We always bought our meat from Ferris Market. We bought beef there for years. Dave came by as a cold call, just walking from restaurant to restaurant, wanting to know if I wanted to buy his beef. And I said, well, Dave, I really appreciate what you're doing. I'd never met him before, but a super nice guy. And I said, Dave, I've been buying meat. We've been buying meat here for 60 years from the Ferris Market. I really just can't stop buying from him. He understood, but we kind of had, we always kept in contact. And then literally overnight, several months later, Ferris Market went out of business, which we had no clue that was going to happen. So scrambling around, my wife and I was trying to figure out what to do. And so light bulb came on, let's call Dave Fisher. And Dave said, sure, I'll work with you. I'll do the best I can. And the rest is history. So I guess we're proud to say we're probably one of his first big customers, and we're very happy with it.
Now they collaborate on the Nick's Burger, a special blend developed by Fisher and Sander Processing just for Rags' restaurant. They also offer Fisher's Steaks on their menu. They use their beef and pork for their chili, ground turkey for their turkey burgers, brisket and pork loin. All this totals up to 500, 600 pounds of meat per week.
Well, it's kind of, I think, what all of us really want to do when you have an independent, smaller restaurant. Even our restaurant seats 400 people, where you can trust the person that is raising your beef and processing your beef.
And as a chef, he says it keeps him creative. The way it works from Fisher's end is chefs call him up or text him on Mondays to place their orders. Then he sends that order sheet to Sander Processing, which receives the animals and then prepares all the ribeyes and sausages. Deliver the orders to the restaurants, and that meat will probably get to customers' plates by that same Friday. The challenge Fisher faces is selling all parts of the animal.
You know, I've got so much ribeye, so much filet, so much strip steak, so much sirloin, and so forth each week, and I've got to figure out which restaurants those are going to.
Which is what makes his relationship with Rags and Nick's English Hut so special.
You know, I'll call him up and say, you know, I am just swimming in sirloin. Can you put a sirloin on your menu? And they've been super to do that.
So week in and week out, Nick's might change their specials based on what extra cuts they get from Fisher. Since Nick's tries to keep its food under $20 a plate, it's the customers who might benefit the most from this setup.
What I've been seeing is that our high-end steaks are generally in high-end restaurants where it's $40 and $50 a plate. But our burgers are higher than the conventional market. But, you know, if Rags might want to add 50 cents to make it cost okay for him for a burger, I think a lot of people are willing to pay an extra 50 cents.
That's one Fisher product you're absolutely guaranteed to see on Nick's menu every single day. The burger is definitely one of their best sellers.
It's a 80% protein, 20% fat blend. Their fat is very natural. It's got like a buttery type flavor. Their meat has an excellent grain to it. Any steak that you have has great marbling, which means it's a great combination of fat and protein together, which gives it a very unique flavor. Also,
Chef Greg Rags Rago and Farmer Dave Fisher. More stories like this at eartheats.org. Hands up. Who still has leftover turkey from Thanksgiving? Anybody? Anybody? How about you make a stew with it? Daniel Orr is starting with some quinoa.
I like to cook them and use them as stuffings and omelets, or to stuff peppers instead of the typical rice. But you can also mix it into soups. And that's one of the things that I've done for you today. Made a little soup. I had some smoked turkey broth, put the quinoa in there, some carrots, some collard greens. You could throw leeks, you could throw turnips, you could throw parsnips, anything you want in there. And then the kumquats, the little oranges that are in there, give it a really fun, interesting flavor and make it very different. And they have a nice citrus pop as you eat them. So kumquat has kind of a sweet, but a touch of bitterness to it. But I think it really goes well with the smokiness of the turkey. It's a way to add excitement to those kind of late winter dishes.
If you do make this recipe, don't skimp on the kumquats. They are these little flavor bullets in the stew. So good. EarthEats.org is the place to find this recipe and everything you heard in today's show.
Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Big thanks to the Earth Eats team, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Harvest Public Media, and Indiana University Food Institute. Our executive producer is John Bailey. This is Kate Young. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats. See you next week.